Welcome to the Vicar Law Podcast, Protecting Legacies, Resolving Conflicts. I'm Lydia Vicar, Director of Vicar Law, where we specialise in succession law, civil disputes and litigation in Queensland. If you want to safeguard your assets, navigate estate planning with confidence, or resolve legal conflicts effectively, you're in the right place. Join me each week as we break down complex legal issues into clear, practical insights, helping you protect your legacy and find solutions with certainty. Let's dive in. Hello and welcome back to the Vicar Law Podcast, Protecting Legacies, Resolving Conflicts. I'm your host, Lydia Vicar, Director of Vicar Law. We are continuing our monthly theme of challenging a will. And this week, we're going to talk about the two biggest issues that I see in terms of people wanting to make a challenge to a will. And that is firstly, capacity, and then secondly, undue influence. So if you didn't listen to last week's podcast, well, you should, but I'll just give a brief recap. So challenging a will is a challenge to say that the will is not the valid will for some kind of reason. And the two biggest reasons that I see are capacity and undue influence. Now, it's not necessarily that those are the two biggest things that are made out by people that they've successfully challenged a will based on those two issues. It's just the two biggest issues that come into play when we're considering whether a will is a valid will, whether the last will was a valid will. So I'll start with capacity. And if you're a long-time listener, you know I'm obsessed with capacity. I don't know how I've got on this tangent, but last year, I went to a conference talking all about capacity in terms of wills and enduring powers of attorney. And I just really love the topic. And I think it's so interesting considering that we have quite an aging population and what that is going to mean for people moving forward. I mean, you know, I say to people 30 years ago, you'd heard of dementia or Alzheimer's, like you'd heard of it, but you didn't really know anyone or have anyone like formally diagnosed. Now, it feels like it's the most overused term in Australia. Whilst rates are, of course, increasing of dementia and Alzheimer's in our society, I think it's also being very much overused. And when it comes to challenging a will, it definitely comes into play. So in terms of capacity for making a will, it's like we'll just step back to kind of an estate planning side. But when someone comes to me to make a will, I am assessing whether they have capacity on a number of things. Now, there's no set test in the legislation. There's no, there's guidelines that we follow. And there is a case that everyone loosely follows when we're doing our own kind of assessment. And I'll just say, sorry, that this is a legal assessment of capacity, not a medical assessment. But if someone comes to me to make a will, I start with the legal kind of assessment. And that's for me as a practitioner to do, as an experienced practitioner. And if I have concerns, then to take kind of other steps. So the first thing we're looking at from this test, and it's called the Banks and Goodfellows test. It's a very, very old English case. It's from 1870, I think, super old. But it follows what we're thinking about when we're trying to determine whether the person making a will has capacity. Okay, so the first thing is the understanding the nature and effect of a will. What does the document mean? What is going to happen, after somebody has passed away? We're trying to see if they understand the consequences of making a will, what it means for their old will. So that's one of the things we're looking at. Now, in terms of that big picture, we're also assessing whether they have an understanding of their assets. This one is a hard one. Some people will say to me, oh, but they didn't even know the value of their home. You don't need to know the value of your home to understand that you own a home. You know, it's an understanding of the assets, so understanding what you own. How you hold them, do you hold them jointly with someone else? Do you hold them individually? Where they are, for example, I've got shares, you know, on ComSec. I think they're Telstra, this, that, and the other, but I couldn't tell you the exact amount. That's fine. You have an understanding of your assets. So that's what I'm talking about in terms of that. The next one is appreciating who, and the wording is, has a bounty on your estate, a bounty on your claim, I think it is. So who has a right to your estate and who has a right to contest your estate. Okay, so this is quite a big one. So in Queensland, the people that have a right to contest your state and may, and you have, I guess, a moral obligation to provide for, that's essentially what the law says, is your spouse and dependents. So spouse, children, and financial dependents of you. So when you have somebody that might be excluding someone from their will or giving them less than their other children, I'm really trying to see if you have an understanding what that means at the other end, like after you have passed away. And I will say this one for me is very determinative of whether I take kind of defensive steps in establishing a will. So if somebody that's quite elderly comes to me and says, oh, I want to leave, let's just say that not married, they're widowed and they have four kids. And they say to me, listen, I want to leave everything to my four kids equally. I just want to change the executor on my will because it was my late husband and my friend, but I just want to update it to be my two oldest children. In those circumstances, I don't really have a huge concern about anyone challenging the will. Okay. And to me, leaving everything to your spouse and then equally to your children is the gold standard. That's what I tell people. That's the gold standard. We can move away from that, but that's the gold standard. And if you're going with the gold standard, I don't have a huge worry that anyone is going to challenge your will because you have properly provided for everyone in your will, okay? When someone that's quite elderly comes to me and says, I want to leave Johnny out because I don't like his wife and his children are delinquents, that's when I start going, oh, okay. Let's do an assessment of capacity. Let's make sure you're not being unduly influenced. Let's make sure that you understand what that means for your will, okay? And then the last thing in Banks and Goodfellow is making sure that the person is free from any mental disorders. And that and dementia, Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, those are the kinds of things that we're looking for there. So when I'm doing a will, I first do my legal assessment, loosely following Banks and Goodfellows, asking questions to ascertain whether I think somebody has capacity. If I have concerns or if I'm moving to being defensive of a will that I am creating, I will then get a medical assessment of capacity done. Now, lots of people say, oh yeah, my GP will sign a letter. In some instances, that's not enough. I really think in some cases, a geriatrician, psychiatrist, are the types of people that you want to assess the capacity, because having a capacity assessment at the time you're making a will is the best assessment. Some people will say to me, oh, what about those MMSE tests that the GP gives? They are indicative, but they are not the sole factor to assess whether or not someone has capacity. And there's lots of things that come into play in those tests. I find older people are very reluctant to say, I can't see, I can't hear you, I have trouble writing because my hands shake. Those are kinds of things that that exam doesn't take into account. And so it's really an assessment, a whole assessment of capacity. We're looking at the interaction with the solicitor, we're looking at the doctor, what kind of doctor's done the assessment, what assessments they have done. I mean, I could really talk about this all day. What I find is that if somebody does have some kind of diagnosis of like early onset dementia or they are getting frail, they usually do have a geriatrician involved. And so it's quite easy to get that medical assessment done. It's much harder to start from a point of not thinking they have a problem and then asking them to get a medical assessment done. So it's a delicate kind of thing, but it's the number one, I think, reason people are really look at the validity of the will. They're thinking, well, you know, things I hear is like, mum didn't understand what she was saying. She didn't have the capacity. She was frail. She was old. Being old does not mean you do not have capacity, but there are a number of other things that do. And so when we're looking at challenging a will, that's the number one thing that we will look at. And I will look at that before I look at any other factor that may have affected the will. I'm asking questions of the person that wants to challenge the will. I'm asking them questions about medical conditions, whether anything was out of the ordinary, whether they were saying weird things. It's all that kind of evidence that we're trying to build in terms of challenging a will. And next week, I'm going to talk about solemn form proceedings, which is how you kind of go about challenging a will. But for today, I just want to keep talking about our two biggest things. Now, so that's pretty much capacity in a very long-winded nutshell. The second thing is undue influence. Okay, so that's probably the second thing that people come to me about. And they'll say things like, you know, my sister stood over her while she was signing. My brother took her to see his solicitor and they did the will together. it's a handmade will. And, you know, she lives with my brother and so he influenced her. Okay, those are the kind of accusations that I'm hearing when we're thinking about undue influence. Undue influence is a very high bar and it's on the applicant, so the person that's challenging the will. They have the burden of proof to show that that person was unduly influenced. And that can be quite difficult to do after somebody has passed away, unless you have some kind of temporaneous notes. Maybe there is some evidence of like police involvement or in medical records talking about feeling coerced or feeling a certain way. It's a very hard bar to reach. Okay. So what I find is lots of people will come to me with these scenarios of like isolation or these really unusual changes that, you know, that really benefit one person in the family, or someone really takes control of their parents. And I'm just, the generalization is children because it's always children challenging their parents' will. That's, I very rarely see anything else. And they're the people that, you know, can really challenge the will. But those are the kinds of things, this active kind of isolation, active control over this deceased person. And that's kind of what we're looking at. So it's a really hard bar to reach. And it's, I would say, you know, fraud, which is another reason, which is really hard to prove. If you're making allegations of fraud, you really have to have the evidence. The court does not like you making those allegations without any evidence. So just putting fraud aside, undue influence is a really, really hard one to prove, but it's usually the first stop in someone seeking some advice, because it may be that there has been this unusual change and there has been this unusual influence, but is it because that they also have lack capacity? Have they had some kind of diagnosis that has made them more susceptible to this undue influence? So that's the kind of thing. And that's why these two really go hand in hand. If I see people, the accusations flitter between kind of both things. And so those are the reasons that people are coming to see me. And those are the two biggest issues I see when we're looking at challenging a will. So I hope that's given you kind of a good overview. If you want to discuss this more, or you have a situation where you think, you know, you've got a problem with somebody you love that has passed away, you can hop on my website, www.vicarlaw.com.au, book a free consultation with me, Lydia Vicar, and we can talk about this. And, you know, as I've said, I love talking about capacity, so I'll probably just talk your ear off if I'm being honest. So next week, we're going to talk about how you actually go about challenging a will. So that is quite interesting, and I was going to say scary, but I don't think that's the right word. But it is interesting, and it's way more complex than people think. So I will leave that for now. Have a great week, and I will speak to you then. Bye. That's a wrap for this episode of the Vicar Law Podcast, Protecting Legacies, Resolving Conflicts. I hope you found today's insights helpful in navigating your legal journey. If you're ready to take the next step in securing your legacy or finally dealing with your dispute, you can pop on my website, www.vicarlaw.com.au, to book a free consultation with me, Lydia Vicar. You can also subscribe to our newsletter or find out more about today's topic. Your future begins now, and we're here to guide you every step of the way. Until next time, I'm Lydia Vicar, signing off. The Vicar Podcast comprises general information and does not serve as a substitute for professional advice. Prior to making any legal decisions, individuals are advised to seek independent professional guidance and assess the suitability of this information for their own individual goals and objectives.